Welcome to this special spin-off audio program on a satellite CME symposium held at the 2019 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, Current and Future Management of ER-Positive Breast Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Harold Burstein, who is a faculty member in our symposium, to review the topics and cases discussed at the meeting, including select audience polling data, and to obtain his perspectives on the current and future management of patients with ER-positive disease. To begin, I asked Dr. Burstein for his perspective on one of the important topics of the symposium, the pivotal Phase 3 TAILOR-X study.
Well, I think that the TAILOR-X study has been a remarkable prospective validation of the whole approach of using a genomic assay to identify which women do not need chemotherapy. And it has, over the past decade, transformed our practice in the U.S. and around the world. There is a lot less chemotherapy being given in the adjuvant setting. And most of the controversies or debates right now are on whether you can extrapolate the data from TAILOR-X to much higher risk cases, reaching the same conclusions when there aren't so much clear prospective data. I think a couple real important points to be made. The first is that, you know, there's an extraordinary body of evidence now behind the 21-gene recurrence score in particular, and more generally, the genomic approach to testing cancers. In many centers around the world, there is still an effort to say, well, can we get the same conclusions using traditional pathology instead of using the genomic assay? And when they've done correlative studies, in large part, they find the same things. You know, low 21-gene recurrence score tends to correlate with low grade, low Ki-67, strong ER-positive expression, and so forth. But there's really no other assay that has the prospective experience. And so for most American practice, the recurrence score remains the standard. And around the world, I think the key takeaway I always give people is it's only after the success of the genomic marker that people have in retrospect been able to say, aha, we can do this with routine pathology. Because before you had the genomic assay, nobody had sufficient confidence to be able to say really that patients didn't need chemo based on strict pathology criteria.
I just want to follow up on one point, and actually I wanted to refer back to Joe Sperano's conclusion slide after he reviewed a lot of the data that we're going to talk about. And one of the things on this conclusion slide is, quote, assays are not interchangeable. And you were kind of saying, well, quote, they sort of say the same thing. But I kind of feel like what I've been seeing is more along the lines of what he has in this slide, which is they aren't necessarily, you take somebody who's had one assay and do another assay, you don't necessarily get the same classification, do you?
Well, it is true that if you use multiple genomic platforms, you will occasionally reassign certain tumors. Having said that, there is tremendous concordance overall between them. And so, you know, the market leader, the standard at our institution, I think the standard in most of the biggest guidelines remains the 21-gene recurrence score, and that's what we lean on very heavily. If someone has had a different test, you know, at an outside center or in an outside program, I don't usually reinvestigate that as long as everything lines up in a reasonable fashion.
And that does tie into another thing I think we brought up at the meeting, which is there ever a role for sort of a second assay in somebody because of the clinical scenario, because of the results of the first assay? They've had a recurrence score, for example, doing a 70 gene.
Yeah. So there probably is not. You know, one of the limitations of the field right now is that it's only describing outcomes for ER-positive breast cancer, really. The 70-gene assay was developed to include HER2-positive and triple-negative cancers, but there's really no decision that you look to that test to help. The other issue relates to node-positive, because in the MINDAC trial, there were a handful of patients who had ER-positive, node-positive breast cancers, and so there were some very small numbers of prospective analyses there. There's been subsequent work from the West German group and other centers now looking at node-positive outcomes for low-risk 21-gene recurrence score results. So I don't see that there's a one product you use in one situation and another product you use in another.
Another point that Joe brought up in this conclusion slide is the question of the 70-gene assay, and he notes that it does provide prognostic information, says, quote, it might be used in clinical high risk, 1 to 3 nodes to spare chemotherapy. So the idea that even though it doesn't have prognostic, the risk is so low that really you're not going to benefit from chemo. What do you think about that thinking?
Well, I think a lot of us are already at that point when it comes to using these assays. So it's very common in our practice to look at postmenopausal women and even sometimes premenopausal women who have limited nodal disease. Typically, we're talking about one or two positive nodes, and to apply a recurrence score test to their case and make a decision. I think for most of us, the feeling is that the biologic principle about where there's going to be benefit for chemotherapy is going to apply to limited nodal disease as well as node negative. But I don't see that that's a unique place where you would use a different assay as opposed to the 21-gene recurrence score.
And you did present a patient of yours, actually, who had, I think it was partial involvement of one node, had a low recurrence score, and you skipped the chemotherapy. And that also gets into this issue of younger versus older patients and the question about chemotherapy. Can you kind of relate, kind of again, what we've learned over this past year, A, about intermediate scores, and B, about clinical high risk, and how age seems to matter, at least at this point?
Right. So there have been a couple of retrospective analyses that have specifically looked at this question of age. In the Taylor X trial, Joe Sperano obviously led a massive effort to compare endocrine therapy alone or endocrine therapy plus chemotherapy for women with intermediate range recurrence scores between 11 and 25. The take-home top-line message was very clean in the original New England Journal of Medicine publication in 2018. There's no benefit for adding chemotherapy to these groups. When they looked at subgroups of patients, particularly the women who had scores, say, of 16 to 20 or 20 to 25 and who were less than age 50, it looked like there might be some benefit to chemotherapy on the order of a few percentage points. So the question has been, is that because of the direct effects of chemotherapy, or is that because of the fact that these are premenopausal women and that chemotherapy actually renders them postmenopausal? And Joe has presented some data in follow-up at the ASCO 2019 meeting and then again published in the New England Journal of Medicine on what the most likely answer to that question is. And I will tell you, my interpretation of that data is that the entire effect is likely due to ovarian suppression. I say that because when you look at the subgroups of women by age, here's how it breaks out. If the woman is less than age 40, if you really think chemotherapy is critical, you might say, well, that's the group that would get the most benefit for chemo. But actually, in that cohort, there was really no benefit for adding chemotherapy, presumably because most of those women do not go into menopause with chemotherapy. And by contrast, as women age in the 40 to 45 age group and then in the 45 to 50 age group, and they are more likely to go into menopause with chemo, you see that there is an increasing role for chemotherapy as you go from 40 to 45, closer to 50. I think the only plausible explanation for that is that it's because of the effects of ovarian suppression. And finally, if you look at the handful of women who were younger than age 50 but already in menopause in the Taylor X trial, again, zero benefit for chemotherapy. So I think the hypothesis that explains all this most readily is that you're seeing the effects of chemotherapy on ovarian function, and you can achieve that without pushing the patient to treatment with chemotherapy.
So does that mean your preferred recommended approach is usually endocrine therapy or ovarian suppression?
Right. So again, we're talking about women, scores 11 to 25, and in the Taylor X trial, node negative patients. If they are premenopausal and if they had higher end scores, 20 to 25 in particular, I often think about adding ovarian suppression to their endocrine therapy. You can pair that with either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. And I think you would achieve whatever marginal benefit you might realize with chemo. The downside, of course, is there's a lot more symptomatology with ovarian suppression than with tamoxifen alone in these women. And you have to both explain that to women and then manage their symptoms as best one can if you push them towards ovarian suppression.
It is interesting, though, that because really it's only been maybe a year and a half, actually, that we've had these data that we're talking about, at least the original intermediate data, how it's been sort of sifting out in people's mind. You know, what you just said, I don't know that you were saying that a few months after we first saw the data, but I think as it's evolved and it's been discussed, and it sounds much more pro-ovarian suppression than, you know, I think when we first saw the data.
Our own take has been pretty much along those lines since the subset data were presented in the original paper.
But I mean, clinically, you've been doing...
Yeah. I think ovarian suppression is a very useful tool for premenopausal women. So in a lot of stage 2 and 3 ER-positive breast cancers, irrespective of whether they get chemotherapy, if those patients remain premenopausal, I'm often inclined to think about ovarian suppression, especially in node-positive breast cancer.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
What's new here also is at the San Antonio meeting, Fatima Cardoso from Portugal presented a similar analysis from the MINDAC trial where they looked at the overall result for women who had clinical higher risk, genomic lower risk cancers, but were premenopausal. And in that space, what was interesting is that they actually saw a whiff of benefit for chemotherapy again, 2-3% difference in outcome. But again, the thinking is largely along the lines that that probably represents the consequences of ovarian suppression from chemotherapy more than chemotherapy alone.
That's really interesting. Anything else that came out of San Antonio relevant to these topics?
Well, there were some updates on management of late recurrence for ER-positive breast cancer. So you may remember 2 years ago, there was a major presentation from the Oxford Overview Group looking at the risk of recurrence after 5 years of tamoxifen therapy. And they had a New England Journal of Medicine paper, and it looked pretty scary. It looked like there was a very high risk of recurrence in years 5 to 10 and even beyond year 10. And almost all groups of women they analyzed, with the exception of women who had low-grade stage 1 breast cancers, carried more than a 10% risk of late recurrence. And that was really influential in pushing a lot of folks towards longer durations of anti-estrogen therapy. At San Antonio in 2019, they more or less walked back the whole thing. They gave an update on those data, but they looked at it for women who were diagnosed before the year 2000 and then after the year 2000. And what was interesting is that in the modern trials, diagnosis after the year 2000, the risk of late recurrence is actually a lot less than what they saw in the women diagnosed before the year 2000, mostly trials running in the 1990s. And that's probably because we've gotten much more sophisticated about obsessing about margins and careful measurements of tumors and tailoring therapy so we're using just enough but not too much and looking at nodes, especially sentinel nodes. But I think my takeaway from that was actually when consulting and advising a patient who's been on endocrine therapy for 5 years and is wondering what their risk of recurrence is, it's probably substantially less than what the original Oxford overview had suggested. Along those lines, there was an update from the NSABP looking at their trial B42, which was a very clean study of women who'd had 5 years of endocrine therapy and then were randomized to ongoing letrozole therapy or to no further treatment. And the benefits there are modest. There's probably about a 3-4% reduction in the risk of recurrence, particularly in women who had node-positive breast cancer. So again, I think what's happening in clinical practice is that we're recommending more endocrine therapy to certain groups of women. That would be obviously premenopausal women who have higher risk cancers who are being advised to get ovarian suppression in addition to endocrine therapy. And then secondly, particularly stage 2 or 3, particularly node-positive breast cancer patients, where we will be pushing longer durations of anti-estrogen treatment to help prevent a recurrence. And by contrast, women with stage 1 disease, women with lower risk tumors, probably 5 years of endocrine therapy is sufficient.
I'm still mulling over what you were saying about the fact that the risk of delayed recurrence may be less than what we thought it was based on older trials.
Those were trials where some of the women had had chemotherapy and some had not. They'd all had 5 years of endocrine treatment. But remember what happened in 2002 was we started to use the aromatase inhibitors far more heavily. And I think that has lowered the risk of both near-term and long-term recurrence. We're doing sentinel node mapping, so we have a much better definition of how much disease there is in the nodes than we used to have. So I think that all fits with contemporary practice.
That's interesting. Maybe, I don't know, is there any reason to think an AI would have more of an effect in terms of delayed recurrence than tamoxifen?
You know, in the big 198 trials, the benefits of the AI are present for a few years. And then if you wait till like year 15, it all kind of smurfs together a little bit more. So I don't have an immediate suggestion as to why that would account for a lower risk of late recurrence. But there is, you know, through year 10, there's a small benefit still favoring the AIs.
You know, just flashing on the ATAC trial when that was presented. That was like, what, 9,000 people or something? I think the biggest
9,000 people. Big 198 was 8,000 people. The exemestane adjuvant trials. There have been over 100,000 patients treated with adjuvant aromatase inhibitors on trial. It's the single most studied drug in the history of medical oncology in that context.
Wow. Yeah, no, amazing. Well, let's talk about the second module where we talked about mainly first-line therapy, metastatic disease, and really the issue of CDK inhibitors. And one of the things that Matt Goetz was presenting in some of the newer data were some of the data that have come out more recently over the impact on survival. And, you know, of course, we're always, you know, looking for that. But I'm just kind of curious, taking a step back from a more macro global point of view. Obviously, it's great if you can add a therapy that's going to have some kind of impact like that. It's not too toxic. But at a more global level, what do you think this really means in terms of the biology and treatment of ER-positive breast cancer?
So again, there have been now 7 randomized trials looking at endocrine therapy with or without CDK4/6 inhibitors in either first or second line of treatment. There have been parallel studies for each of the 3 commercially available CDK4/6 inhibitors, palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib. And the results have been incredibly consistent. I don't think you could find large randomized phase 3 studies with such similar fundamental, you know, hazard ratios and things. These drugs clearly improve progression-free survival, and with longer follow-up now are showing survival signals in the years to come. I think it's a great step forward for ER-positive breast cancer patients, which is still the most common kind of metastatic breast cancer. And these are reasonably well-tolerated drugs. They had become our standard of practice before the overall survival data benefit emerged. You know, it was clear that these improvements really doubling progression-free survival, extending the use of endocrine treatment. And here's a really nice thing all these studies have also shown. They've also shown you can delay the time to onset of chemotherapy. Even if you didn't have a survival benefit, I think that alone would have been a compelling reason to use these drugs. It is so much nicer for the patient to be able to put these pills in her medicine cabinet or carry them in her pocketbook and do the things she wants to do, whether it's visit family and friends around the world or just go to the mall and not have to worry about going in for chemo all the time. It's a huge advantage for this class of drugs.
I was kind of alluding also to the biology in terms of the fact that, I mean, theoretically, and this is true in the adjuvant setting, you know, the trials of tamoxifen, for example, you can treat people in relapse. And the question is there some biologic reason that giving earlier endocrine therapy now in the metastatic setting really makes a difference?
Well, I don't have a good answer for that. They've looked at mechanisms of sensitivity and resistance to CDK4/6 inhibitors. And in contrast to the story like in lung cancer with EGFR mutation, where there's a single evolution of a point mutation and that sort of explains it, there's been no such immediately identified point mutation for resistance to CDK4/6. So there's a lot of physiologic stuff, upregulation of CD6 itself, downregulation of RB, other intracellular changes, but it's been hard to pinpoint a single molecular mechanism. I think one of the things that I've taken away from looking at this is that in modern practice, most of these patients will have already seen endocrine therapy before for early stage breast cancer. And so you're kind of supercharging what you're doing when you're reintroducing endocrine therapy to them. And I think that may account for why there is a significant benefit.
So one of the things we talked about, and we kind of worked our way through this by asking the audience a bunch of questions, but just more to take a step back and think a little bit about several clinical scenarios that you see in practice and whether there's any difference in how you would think it through in terms of A, whether you're going to use a CDK inhibitor, and B, what endocrine therapy you're going to combine it with. And the 3 situations from a teaching point of view we've talked a lot about is the patient who presents upfront, de novo disease, never had endocrine therapy. The patient who's in the middle of receiving adjuvant endocrine treatment, you can argue it doesn't matter if it's 2 years or 5 years, but they're on endocrine treatment when they develop mets. And then the third being somebody who had prior endocrine therapy, you know, for example, 5 years or whatever, had it stopped and then recurred off treatment, but with that prior history. Can you talk about those 3 groups and kind of how you approach them in terms of CDK or not and which endocrine therapy?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's really a great spectrum of cases, and we see women in each of those categories all the time. So for de novo metastatic disease, usually they have multiple sites of disease. And for them, we usually initiate endocrine therapy, typically with an aromatase inhibitor or ovarian suppression and an aromatase inhibitor. And we also add a CDK4/6 inhibitor. So the FDA has actually done a large meta-analysis of all of these trials of first and of second-line therapy. And they've looked at all the clinical subgroups, women women who had de novo disease, women who had lobular only, women who had bone only metastasis versus other, women who, every imaginable sort of major clinical scenario you can think of. And the relative benefits of the CDK4/6 inhibitors are exactly the same in every subgroup. They cannot find a clinical subgroup that does not seem to have improved progression-free survival with the use of a CDK4/6 inhibitor. So many places say, well, you know, do they need it up front? And I think in general, the answer is that should be the default posture. Now, there are always individuals who, for whatever reason, you might not want to do it. So a woman who has truly an isolated metastatic focus. You know, she might have had early stage breast cancer, been staged. After surgery, you find a single bone metastasis and it's been irradiated. Does that person have to be on a CDK4/6 inhibitor? Sure, you can spare that person for a while. Or someone who has a recent surgery and is healing and you don't want to mess with wound repair or something like that, or for whatever reason, doesn't want to take the medicine. But those are individual decisions. I think in the aggregate, the default posture should be to include a CDK4/6 inhibitor.
You know, it's interesting. We're always surveying people in terms of what they do. And we did a survey, and it was about a year ago, so maybe things have changed, but of general medical oncologists. And the one subset that we saw that not everybody used to CDK, I mean like 75%, but not all, was the de novo patient. And I don't know what the thinking might have been.
I don't have an answer for that, but in the Mona Lisa 7 trial, which was probably the cleanest study of this because it was premenopausal women with almost the majority of them having de novo metastatic disease, there was actually clear survival benefit for early addition of the CDK4/6 inhibitor.
So the other question is, what's the endocrine partner? There have been debates about what's the optimal first-line endocrine therapy in a de novo patient just to start with. What about somebody who's won an AI? What about somebody who's had an AI?
For sure. So for the de novo patient, I usually begin an AI. And if the patient is premenopausal, I also would initiate concurrent ovarian suppression. The concurrent ovarian suppression goes back to a very old literature. You may be the only one who remembers these papers in your audience, but there were studies a long time ago which showed that compared to tamoxifen alone, ovarian suppression and tamoxifen improved progression-free survival for women who had de novo metastatic disease in the premenopausal setting. So I think that is the default standard. And for convenience, we usually just give it with an AI. And I like the oral medications there. They're portable, they're easy, and most women tolerate them reasonably well.
Incidentally, I don't know if you know that we actually started Research to Practice by getting a grant to do a video called Endocrine Therapy for the 1980s. It was like tamoxifen or metastatic disease.
Well, it's the original targeted therapy. You know,
it really is. It totally
when I
is.
Give the talk to our fellows, you know, I make that point. Look, this, we were using this. Bill McGuire and people like that were characterizing ER in the 70s and 80s, and this was a remarkable story. And, you know, it's a paradigm that seems less exciting nowadays compared to osimertinibs or, you know, plasma match sequencing to link up ALK inhibitors and all that. But the principles were all established in the treatment of ER-positive breast cancer.
Yeah, you know, I was a fellow with Chuck Vogel, and, you know, I'm just kind of looking around and comparing quality of life to these people who are getting tamoxifen to the people who are getting chemotherapy. And that really is why I started, you know, getting involved with the education. It's so striking how different it was.
When you look at the giants of real clinical breast cancer medicine over the past 25, 30 years, the Aaron Goldhirsches, the Martine Picarts, the Ian Smiths in Europe, the Nancy Davidsons and George Sledges, the vast majority of them cut their teeth on endocrine therapy and early stage breast cancer. That's been, you know, a remarkable innovation. Obviously, the HER2 story has, you know, been the parallel story with Dr. Sleiman's contributions and others.
So just to finish out, though, in terms of choice of endocrine therapy, what about the patient who's been on an AI? Does it matter if they've been on 2 years versus 5 years? And obviously the question of fulvestrant versus, you know, some other strategy.
So for women who've been on AI therapy at the time of recurrence, I almost always switch to fulvestrant for a couple reasons. One is that's where the actual literature lies. There are very few data on continuing AI therapy and introducing a CDK4/6. But the second point really gets to the biological mechanisms of resistance. And with increased genomic sequencing of metastatic breast cancer, probably about half of all the tumors that recur on or after AI therapy have these acquired mutations in ESR1, which can constitutively activate the estrogen receptor. And so I think you're getting very little yield for the use of more AI in such patients. So I routinely switch to fulvestrant and then, if they haven't had it already, introduce the CDK4/6 inhibitor. The question arises in women who, you know, finished their AI therapy a while ago and now have recurrent disease. And they're sort of an arbitrary choice. In my own mind, if they recur within 2 years after an AI, I would switch them to fulvestrant. If it's more than 2 years, I think it's okay to try the aromatase inhibitor, but that's totally arbitrary. And most of the trials actually used a one-year benchmark for that AI sensitivity.
You know, you were mentioning fulvestrant, and, you know, fulvestrant's been out a long time, but, you know, I always thought, like, more was going to happen with it. It's, when I first heard about it, it seemed, like, so interesting, and, you know, it didn't really seem like that much really happened, and now we're hearing about these oral SERDs. Do you think that's going to make a difference?
So the interesting thing about the SERDs is they are a class of drugs that should work. I mean, there is a target that's defined. There's an easy pharmacodynamic readout. You treat patients, and you measure the tumor pre and post, and you see if you've degraded the estrogen receptor, lost estrogen receptor. And yet it's been really hard to develop these drugs. They've actually been more toxic or more difficult to biodeliver than people had imagined. And so they've been talking about SERDs for 8 or 10 years. It's been a long while to get them to market. There were several posters at San Antonio on new SERDs. And, you know, again, they look to have activity. They look like they're ironing out some of the GI and tolerability issues. So I expect that we'll see them in the market in the years ahead. But I'm with you. It's a class of drugs that absolutely should be straightforward, and it's been a lot harder to bring forward than you would have guessed.
So the other thing I want to ask you about in terms of CDK inhibitors is selection of CDK. And again, Matt makes his point in his summary slide that the differences in toxicity profiles might be considered in selection, that it's difficult to compare efficacy head-to-head, but he notes the question of specific CDKs in poor prognosis patients, Abema, for example, liver mets, or primary endocrine resistance, FGFR, EGFR, et cetera, Abema and Ribo in improved survival in difficult-to-treat situations, Ribo, premenopausal Abema, second line. So with all that sort of whizzing around a little bit, can you talk a little bit about some of the issues, I think, that are out there in terms of selection of CDK?
So there are three commercially available products, as you know, and the first sort of big analysis point is that I think these drugs are interchangeable. I think the effects are all very similar. As I mentioned earlier, the hazard ratios are almost all identical. They do differ a little bit in side effect profile. So palbociclib and ribociclib are really, really similar products. 3 weeks on, 1 week off. Neutropenia is the dominant laboratory side effect, though it's very rare to see febrile neutropenia. Abemaciclib has slightly less neutropenia, but slightly more in the way of diarrhea. My own personal experience has been that the palbociclib is the most easy drug for patients to tolerate. The laboratory artifacts of the neutropenia are managed either with follow-up or with dose reduction. And actually, parenthetically, there's a very nice study the Canadians ran where they compared 125 versus 100 of palbociclib. There's no difference in outcomes, so there's no worry about dose reduction. And not having diarrhea is an appealing profile for many patients. So mostly when I talk to community docs or others, I say, talk to your team, talk to your patients, figure out which product you think is most effective and tolerable for your patients, and then just use it in everybody so that you have educational materials and familiarity and consistency across your practice. And I think that's the smart way to do it. Now, at San Antonio, there's a very interesting abstract, a small study from Moffitt Cancer Center, where they looked at the use of abemaciclib after treatment previously with palbociclib based on pharmacy records. And this raises a really interesting question as to whether ongoing CDK4/6 inhibition beyond progression is helpful. And as you know, palbociclib is indicated in combination with endocrine therapy, as is Abema, but Abema has a secondary label for single agent therapy. So in the real world, it often happens that patients will get one CDK4/6 inhibitor and progress and then might be offered a different CDK4/6 inhibitor in the future. So they did a chart review on about 20 patients, and they found that if you'd previously had palbociclib and then progressed, And then about 20 patients were offered abemaciclib down the road. They found that abemaciclib worked for about 3 months and that about 20% of patients had some kind of clinical response, not an official response, but just a clinical benefit. So I think there are some nuggets of data that that's not a crazy thing to do. We all do it on occasion, and I've had a few patients, you know, who clearly seem to do well with that second go around.
That's really, actually, that was what I wrote down as the next thing I was going to ask you about was abema monotherapy, but that's really interesting. What about this other thing that Matt notes about abema in poor risk, liver mets, et cetera?
Yeah, so, I mean, there really haven't been head-to-head comparisons, and I'm not sure I would put too much stock in some of these subset ideas. One of the interesting things about abemaciclib is it does seem to have CNS penetration, and there has been discussion as to whether that might make it preferable. The reality is that for most women with ER-positive breast cancers, you don't see brain metastases or CNS metastases during the course of their endocrine therapy. It's very rare to see that. So whether that provides a clinically compelling distinction is not so clear in my mind.
You know, it's funny when you're talking about the fact that you can superimpose the data. I was flashing on that slide that you show where you go, I know I'm not supposed to show this, but then you compare the three. So I always cite that slide because this happens all the time in other CME areas. We had a small cell lung cancer thing recently where durvalumab and atezo was exactly, somebody put it on the same slide. I said, well, that's the Halberstein effect.
Well, if you get bored on a Saturday afternoon, you can take the PowerPoints of the Kaplan-Meier curves from the various publications and you sort of have to play with them to rescale them. But then if you print them out, cut them out and hold them up to the light, they are superimposable. It's a good exercise for fellows on a quiet day.
So let's talk about the next module where you actually gave the talk, which looked at therapy beyond CDK and particularly the issue of alpelisib and the mutation testing, et cetera. Can you talk about what you consider state of the art in terms of managing patients who are progressing on a CDK inhibitor plus endocrine therapy? First, I'll ask you, any kind of mutation testing, liquid biopsies you think might be a consideration?
Yeah, so, you know, the availability of alpelisib, the PIK3CA targeted drug, has really changed our approach to some of the genomic testing. You know, we largely had been doing that as a research tool. We certainly encountered a lot of patients who'd had genomic profiling of their tumor. But in ER-positive breast cancer, the mutations are fairly uncommon. It's not a disease where you see tons and tons and tons of random mutations or even consistent mutations. What you see is ESR1 mutations. And of course, what we also knew was that a lot of patients had PIK3CA mutations. About 30% of ER-positive cases will harbor such a mutation. So first-line treatment, I think, is a CDK4/6 inhibitor with endocrine therapy. And then at some point during their course of treatment, we also now determine the PIK3CA status of the tumor. That can be done on the primary tumor block with traditional genomic testing, if you will. But increasingly, we've actually been using the liquid biopsy available from several commercial vendors. And that's a very nice readout for whether or not a PIK3CA mutation is present. Obviously, a negative study, there are still false negatives in that space because you don't always have cell-free DNA circulating in the plasma. But a positive study is very informative and would justify the use of alpelisib once the patient's already finished with their CDK4/6 inhibitor treatment.
So just to kind of reflect back on that and the data that sort of led into it, can you talk about the SOLAR trial and the impact that was seen there? And also what was seen there as well as what's been seen in clinical practice in terms of toxicity?
Yeah, so the SOLAR study compared outcomes for endocrine therapy alone with fulvestrant versus that plus alpelisib, the alpha-selective PI3 kinase inhibitor. And they had two cohorts of patients in this trial by design. One was a group of patients who had a PIK3CA mutation, and the other was a group who had a PIK3CA wild type. And what they showed was that in the women whose tumors had a PI3 kinase mutation, there was a clear benefit to adding alpelisib, something on the order of about a 4 to 6 month improvement in progression free survival, and a really important negative control, which was that in the women who did not harbor that mutation in their tumors, there was absolutely no benefit of alpelisib. So I think that right away clarified who should get alpelisib and who should not. They've also shown in some small subset analysis the outcomes for alpelisib in women who've already had CDK4/6 inhibition, and there is benefit to treating those women who have PIK3CA mutations after CDK4/6, but not surprisingly, the magnitude of that benefit is smaller because the patients progress a little earlier in second-line therapy. So that's been really helpful. And that's why, as I said, I think at some point during the course of their CDK4/6 inhibitor therapy or towards the end of it, one tries to obtain the PIK3CA mutation status.
So just to clarify, though, in terms of testing, I think there's a one-off test specifically approved with the FDA indication. Do you do that, or you do sort of a multiplex, you know, liquid or tissue and include PIK3 as part of it or have it included?
So usually what we've been requesting has been multiplex assays for multiple genes based either on liquid or on solid tumor testing. It really depends in part on the patient's insurance coverage and the accessibility of older archived tissue biopsy. If the patient doesn't have insurance coverage, then, you know, the easiest way is the specific diagnostic test that was approved as a companion to the alpelisib approval.
So now, is this just a straightforward, you know, specific PIK3 mutation, or is it like you were talking about EGFR, for example, there they have, you know, several different variations. What are you testing for here?
You're testing for a specific cluster of PIK3CA mutations, but they can tell you on the report whether it's a variant of unknown significance or whether it's one of the deleterious or activating mutations.
And, you know, just from the perspective of the general medical oncologist, I ask the lymphoma people all the time, well, how does this you know, they obviously are using different PI3 kinase inhibitors, FL, they're 3 approved, CLL, they're 2 approved. And, you know, the oncologist is using them there. They don't do mutation testing at all. They just treat. There's the issue of tolerability. When I ask the lymphoma people, they don't really know much about what's going on with breast cancer, vice versa. But for us out here listening to you all, it kind of seems like in some way they're similar. Same name, anyhow.
Well, alpelisib has a unique side effect profile that people need to know about. Like other mTOR inhibitors, it can cause pneumonitis and atypical rashes and things. But the big thing with alpelisib is the incidence of hyperglycemia. So at least 2/3 of patients who start this medicine will develop significant hyperglycemia, requiring introduction of drugs like metformin to manage that. And, you know, that's a non-trivial problem for patients. They don't like it on the laboratory screens. People understandably don't like the idea that they're being given diabetes. Now, the company has said, this isn't diabetes, it's just hyperglycemia, which on the one hand is sort of true. On the other hand, that's a piece that you have to explain to patients. So it's not a drug without side effects. And that relates to the fundamental biology of the drug. The pathway, the PI3 kinase pathway, evolved, you know, a gazillion years ago to help cells regulate glucose metabolism. And so it's not a big surprise that that's an on-target effect.
Right. And again, thinking about it from a general medical oncologist in lymphoma, you have copanlisib, which is IV, and they get like this hyperglycemia right after the infusion, then it goes away, no problem, don't treat it, leave it alone. So I'm just saying oncologists are hearing different things. Obviously, they're completely different drugs.
This is a more, because you take the drug every day, you know, it's a more
exactly,
ongoing problem.
Right.
And here's the real issue. Most oncologists went into oncology because they didn't want to read EKGs or manage diabetes. And so when you start to have drugs that require EKG monitoring or glucose monitoring, we're all like, oh my God, this is really complicated. Give me neutropenia any day.
So the other thing is, going beyond hyperglycemia, what about quality of life? We were just at a symposium. We had a couple of breast investigators there who maybe they didn't have as much experience as, say, you all do, because you've really done a lot of research, but they were kind of saying, hey, these are not easy drugs, quality of life, not just the diabetes. I forget what it was, rash or something. I don't know.
I think there's something to that. You know, the mTOR inhibitor pathway drugs, the PI3 kinase pathway drugs, there have been some experimental reports on the AKT inhibitors, which are sort of the intermediary in that same pathway. These drugs have side effects, you know, fatigue, rash, pneumonitis, diarrhea, hyperglycemia. They're not the easiest class of tyrosine kinase inhibitor to manage.
So the other thing that came out at the meeting is, you know, prior to alpelisib coming on board, a common approach was to use everolimus. And I always thought everolimus is actually pretty effective. I mean, people kind of got scared away because of the mucositis. But, I mean, you look at the hazard rate, it seemed like it was pretty effective. And I guess my question is, even though it's kind of fancy, you have the mutation, et cetera, I mean, would patients even with PIK3 mutations do as well or better with everolimus?
So when they've looked in the past at the Bolero studies, which were the everolimus studies, they never really saw a strong interaction between PIK3CA status and benefit from everolimus. So either it's just sufficiently different or there's no immediate signal. You know, it is a drug we use, again, usually after CDK4/6 inhibition in patients who are candidates for ongoing endocrine therapy. In my own experience, it's kind of a bimodal drug. There are some patients who just tolerate it beautifully and have hardly any significant side effects, and there are other patients who really have a struggling time with the mTOR inhibitor. And so you sort of try it and see how it plays out. Undoubtedly, the real benefit will be smaller after a CDK4/6 inhibitor, just as it was with the alpelisib subset analysis. Of course, you can't do that in the Bolero studies because they were done before the CDK4/6 inhibitor era.
I guess I'm just saying, do we have any reason to believe that everolimus would be less effective than alpelisib?
Hasn't been compared. It's a good question. I don't have a good answer for that. I think in the wild-type PI3 kinase patients, certainly everolimus seems to be a drug that can work, whereas alpelisib seems not to.
So the last topic that we talked about was sort of future direction, and actually you kind of got into it with your talk also, because I had asked you to check out what was going on with venetoclax in breast cancer, because we've been, you know, we had just come from ASH, and you can imagine we did an entire symposium on AML, and like 90% it was about venetoclax, which is really amazing. You know, again, we were working with Rich Stone and a bunch of other people. But when we were talking to the leukemia people, they were going, well, you know, biologically, maybe we see similar things in breast cancer stem cells. So whatever. And then I saw there was a randomized trial looking at it. Asked you to check it out. What do you think?
Yeah, so my understanding at ASH is they more or less are now putting venetoclax in the bottles of water they're handing out to attendees. Same with pembrolizumab at ASCO, I suppose. It's just, you know, you register for the meeting and you get a supply of pembrolizumab. You know, what's interesting is that BCL2 is expressed in many breast cancer lines and in many breast cancers in people. And there have been some provocative data. There was a randomized study of tamoxifen with or without venetoclax, and it looks to be reasonably well tolerated. And there was some hint that this would improve progression-free survival in ER-positive advanced breast cancer. So there are these studies getting underway, and I think it's kind of a cool thing to explore. So hopefully, I mean, wouldn't that be great if there was this whole new class of drugs that you could bring into the breast cancer space? In retrospect, you know, that's one of the surprising things about the CDK4/6 inhibitors. You know, if you go back to 2010, you didn't hear a lot of people really talking clinically about CDK4/6 as this great pathway to go after in breast cancer, and yet now it's a $7 billion a year drug market, and this is a standard of care with three commercially available products. And, you know, to introduce a whole class of drugs like that over a decade is really quite remarkable. So, you know, there's a lot of things still being sorted out with advanced breast cancer. The role of immunotherapy, I think, is the single biggest piece. There's been some fits and starts and some provocative findings in triple negative breast cancer. ER positive breast cancer, so far it's been, you know, swings and misses, but, you know, there's still interest in figuring out if you can get a second wave of IO products to make more of an impact. There's interest in looking at combining anti-HER2 therapies with immunotherapy and all sorts of things. The HER2 positive space continues to evolve remarkably fast, and I'm sure you're doing a session on the new DSA201 data, the second antibody drug conjugate, and the tucatinib data from the HER2 CLIMB study. So, you know, breast cancer had a bit of a fallow time for a few years, but we're back, baby, and I think that there's really a lot happening in the overall space again.
Yeah, the GI people are all excited about tucatinib and trastuzumab deratuxam, and, you know, whoa, yeah, interesting. And yeah, it is amazing. And also the idea, this thing about with venetoclax, you know, taking and just trying in a completely different area. Anyhow, let me just give you a chance to reflect back on the San Antonio meeting in general. Any other data sets, even outside of ER positive, that you want to comment on, that particularly ones that maybe docs in practice ought to know about?
Well, we talked a little bit about the HER2 innovations, and if you're covering them elsewhere, I won't recapitulate, but, you know, they're going to be two new HER2 drugs where the reports were at the San Antonio meeting and, of course, published concurrently in the New England Journal of Medicine. The first is with trastuzumab deruxtecan, the DSA201 molecule. That was approved already on a single-arm phase 2 study showing a 60% response rate in a very heavily pretreated patient population, women who had already had trastuzumab and pertuzumab and T-DM1. The key thing oncologists will need to know about that is there remains a significant risk of pneumonitis. 10 to 15% of the patients developed clinically significant pneumonitis, and actually 2 to 3% died from pneumonitis. So this is a very potent drug, but it does have some serious side effects that you have to be aware of. The other is the HER2 CLIMB study where, again, a very heavily pretreated patient population, trastuzumab, T-DM1, randomized to trastuzumab plus capecitabine, and then with or without tucatinib, the small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor, an improvement in progression-free survival, an improvement in overall survival. It's expected that drug will be on the market later this year. What's really interesting to me about this is that we now have evidence that through four or five lines of therapy, targeting HER2 is a highly effective intervention. And, you know, it's not obvious that that would be the case, but, you know, ongoing HER2-targeted therapy really helps patients even after three or four lines of HER2-targeted therapy. And I think that's really interesting. And getting to the point we discussed earlier, nobody knows what accounts for resistance to HER2-directed treatment. So there's never been a mutation in HER2 that's been uniquely identified as providing resistance. We know that clinically, the tumor evolves, but biologically, we have not a clue. And so we're still using these same drugs, tucatinib being the drug to inhibit the tyrosine kinase activity of HER2, DSA201, a small antibody-drug conjugate that's essentially a biosimilar trastuzumab linked to a different chemotherapy. And, you know, they're the same drugs, and yet they work over and over and over again. And it's really incredible to me. The takeaway I have is you never take your foot off of that HER2 brake in the management of HER2-positive advanced breast cancer.
So actually, that brings up another issue I was going to ask you about as it relates to the ER-positive symposium we've been talking about, which is the management of triple-positive disease and the use of endocrine therapy in HER2-positive metastatic disease, including CDK inhibitors, where we did see one of your colleagues presented at ESMO some data that I think it was called the MONARCH HER study.
Yeah. So there's two things there. The first is that in clinical practice, half of HER2-positive cancers are also ER-positive. And those patients will benefit from endocrine therapy. So a typical story is, you know, you'll begin them first line with like chemotherapy, trastuzumab, pertuzumab. They'll have a good clinical response. And then after a few months, you'll peel off the chemotherapy part and introduce endocrine therapy. And in clinical practice, that can go on for years. You can have anti-estrogen treatments with the anti-HER2 drugs and help control the tumor. Then the other question is, can you combine these approaches? And so Shyam Goyal, who was an investigator in our group and is now running his own lab in Melbourne, has done some beautiful work showing that there are interactions between ER signaling and HER2 signaling, and that in combination with trastuzumab, CDK4/6 inhibitors should have biologic activity. And the MONARCH HER trial looking at abemaciclib in combination with anti-HER2 drugs has shown provocative findings in terms of clinical response to that combination. So I think there are ways of piecing all this together. There haven't been definitive studies to prove what's the best strategy yet.
So can you describe a clinical situation where you have or you would use a CDK inhibitor in somebody with HER2-positive metastatic disease?
So I've had a few patients where they're on the anti-HER2 antibodies. They've been on endocrine therapy, say with, you know, letrozole. Perhaps they have some subtle degree of progression. I've tried sprinkling a little bit of CDK4/6 inhibition in there to see if it might, you know, enhance the period of tumor control with the simple biologics. And, you know, I've seen it work and I've seen it not work. I don't know what that adds up to.
If you saw a second opinion of somebody who was being treated in the first line for metastatic triple positive disease, and the first opinion person had suggested to, whether Cleopatra or whatever, but had suggested using endocrine therapy plus CDK first line at some point in maintenance,
yeah,
whatever.
Probably not first line. You know, I think that given the survival benefit in the Cleopatra study, that has pride of place with chemo.
Well, you can do both though, right?
Right. So that's, well, and that's one of the interesting things about HER2-positive metastatic disease. You know, the patients who are going out of these trials are getting it in third, fourth, fifth line and beyond treatment. We don't see that much recurrent HER2-positive breast cancer anymore. One of the fascinating talks at San Antonio was the six-year update for the adjuvant pertuzumab trial, the AFFINITY study. And in low-risk, node-negative patients, the six-year disease-free survival was 95% for node-negative patients, and it was 89-90% for node-positive patients. And so, you know, HER2-positive disease is this extraordinary, great success for early-stage treatment. We still see some recurrences, particularly high-risk tumors. We see tumors that are heterogeneous with HER2 that may recur. And, of course, we see de novo metastatic disease. But low-risk patients are doing phenomenally well.
So we're talking about future directions in endocrine therapy. What are your thoughts about other investigational strategies designed to target the PI3K/AKT/mTOR pathway? And one I've heard a lot of talk about recently is the AKT inhibitor capivasertib. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, so the pathway looks like this. There's PI3 kinase, then there's AKT, and then there's mTOR. And they all feed down and have some vague interactions with growth factors and estrogen receptor. And you can target that pathway. So we now have everolimus, and of course we have alpelisib, as we've been discussing. So in the middle there is AKT. And so the drugs seem to have clinical activity, and actually they've had activity in triple-negative breast cancer as well in randomized phase 2 studies. The downside is they share the same side effect profile, hyperglycemia, pneumonitis, rash, mucositis, diarrhea. And so they're not, again, the easiest drugs to take. One of the challenges, which you've already alluded to, is are these drugs really different from our existing drugs? And that's going to be an important question.
Another question in terms of research, but also current practice, relates to the use of CDK inhibitors in patients with localized disease, neoadjuvant therapy, adjuvant therapy, stage 4 NED. So my question is, A, when are we going to start seeing some answers, some clinical trials in these areas? And are there any clinical situations right now where you consider that outside a trial?
So there have been several large adjuvant-type studies conducted. We were very involved in the PALLAS trial, which was an adjuvant palbociclib study. There have been other studies that have also completed accrual of thousands of patients. So I'm hopeful that by the end of 2021, if not sooner, we might begin to see the first wave of those adjuvant data. It takes time for ER-positive disease because of the nature of the disease and the fact that they tend to have later recurrences overall. So I think within a couple of years, though, we will have these adjuvant data. And, you know, based on what we've seen in the metastatic setting, obviously the hope is that they will be effective in the early stage setting as well. I don't think there's any routine use of CDK4/6 inhibitors at this point in early stage disease. The one place I have used it sometimes has been in local regional recurrence where, you know, they do have recurrent breast cancer. And if you're thinking that they need systemic therapy, it might be an effective option. The other place we've been using it in clinical trial is in the neoadjuvant space. And there were some studies at San Antonio on the use of neoadjuvant CDK4/6 inhibitors. The dilemma here is that for ER-positive breast cancers, the endpoints for neoadjuvant treatment are not so well established. You know, pathologic complete responses remain very rare. Tumors typically shrink, but they will often have residual disease. So what the investigators in the so-called Coraline study did is they looked at this sort of pharmacodynamic endpoint of decreased Ki-67 expression and other sort of signals of response. And they showed that you could use a CDK4/6 plus endocrine therapy approach and achieve at least as good or pretty close to as good a response that way as with chemotherapy. And so I think where that is taking us is, and this gets back to where we began our conversation. We began our conversation saying, who with ER-positive breast cancer needs chemotherapy? And I think that as we get more experience using CDK4/6 with hormone treatment in early stage neoadjuvant patients, you begin to see where you're going to be pushing that for higher risk cancers instead of chemotherapy in the years to come. And so, you know, it's great news for breast cancer. There's going to be fewer and fewer women who have ER-positive breast cancer who are going to be candidates for chemotherapy in the early stage of their disease as CDK4/6 inhibitors move forward.
When you were saying looking at risk in the neoadjuvant setting, were you referring to genomic assays?
So that's usually clinical. These are women who present with larger tumors.
I'm just saying in the future.
Yeah. Oh, in the future, for sure. Because, I mean, we're already at the point where we can use the genomic assays to say that chemotherapy doesn't help. But, you know, as we began discussing, TAILORx was node negative. As you know from our remarks, I'm willing to extend that to limited nodal disease. The question still arises, you know, you got somebody who's got an 8-centimeter lobular breast cancer with probably some nodal involvement. You know, can you skip chemotherapy in that patient, which has a low biological risk but a high anatomic stage? I think where we're going to see this move in the next few years is using effective drugs like CDK4/6 inhibitors to hopefully obviate the need for chemo and have patients do better.
You're talking about neoadjuvant studies, and we're talking about Abema monotherapy. I think I remember that there was a neoadjuvant study where they did Abema endocrine therapy neo, and they were looking at Ki-67, but they saw a pretty big bump with just Abema alone. I think it was comparable to, you know, with the hormone therapy.
Yeah, and these are clearly on-target effects, you know. So the role of CDK4/6 is to help drive the G1 to S transition. So if you effectively target that, your readout should be a lower Ki-67 score. That is, you know, that proves the drug is hitting what it's supposed to hit.
Right. And I mean, the one situation that I wondered about, I'm sure it's very uncommon, you know, as you always say in meetings, the Neil Love situation, but is the patient with ER positive, HER2 negative disease who wants that breast conserving surgery, the surgeon wants you to shrink it down, maybe you got a recurrence score and it's low, you know, in that situation, if you need a response, would you try to get a CDK inhibitor?
So, you know, at the moment, there aren't really data that that's the case, but I think that's where we're going. And my guess is if you look at some provocative studies that are being done in the metastatic setting comparing endocrine therapy plus CDK4/6 versus chemo, the response rates look very similar and the outcomes look very similar. So in those genomic low-risk chemo-insensitive cancers, you're probably going to get at least as good a response with the endocrine therapy. One of the problems with neoadjuvant endocrine therapy is it takes a long time to optimally work. And, you know, we're talking at least 6 months and probably out to a year. And that's where the realities of clinical care come in because, you know, plastic surgeons are ready to go and patients are often a little uncomfortable waiting a year, but that's how long it takes to see the optimal result.
Interesting. So the last thing I just want to bring up to you is something I was mentioning in all three of the symposia we did at San Antonio, which is the recent passing of Dr. Bernard Fisher, who really started the NSABP. And, you know, I thought about the fact that, you know, fellows and people who just came into the field maybe don't really know that story. And a really incredible story of how he impacted the treatment of breast cancer. I'm just kind of curious if you have any personal recollections or thoughts about that.
So I never had the pleasure of really speaking with Dr. Fisher, but I've been a huge fan of his work, of the NSABP and the trials they've done. Full disclosure, I work on their data safety and monitoring board as part of my professional responsibilities. But Dr. Fisher, I thought, deserved the Nobel Prize for demonstrating that breast cancer was a systemic disease as much as a local disease. And in the canonical trials, NSABP, B04, and B06, they showed that mastectomy or even radical mastectomy did not improve outcomes compared to more limited breast surgery. And that transformed the whole world of how we take care of women with breast cancer. And it was a remarkable triumph and was really due to his genius at both trial design but also engaging surgeons around the country to participate in this trial at a time when that was an unheard of thing to do. And if you compare progress in breast cancer compared to some other malignancies, you know, the reason there's been so much progress in breast cancer has been because of the cooperative groups, and in particular the NSABP's effort to get people to work together, and then start counting the contributions the NSABP made, which are canonical. So adjuvant tamoxifen, they did the studies. Adjuvant chemotherapy, they did the studies. They developed CMF. The use of AC chemotherapy, that was from the NSABP. The proof that neoadjuvant therapy could be as effective as adjuvant, could downstage the patient surgically, and that PCR was a prognostic marker. All of that was proven in B18. The use of trastuzumab was in an NSABP and North Central Cooperative Group trial. The fact that you don't need to do margins bigger than no ink on tumor, that was from the NSABP. The negative predictive value of a sentinel lymph node, that was the NSABP. Prevention studies, tamoxifen, and then the follow-on trials, that was from the NSABP. The NSABP also was amongst the first to store tumor blocks and do extensive correlations, and it was because of the 21 gene recurrence score they were able to go back and link their assay to trials like B14 and B20. And so the reason that we can use the 21 gene recurrence score and the reason that chemotherapy has plummeted in its use for ER positive disease is because of the NSABP. All those trials guided by Dr. Fisher, one trial after another. It is an unparalleled contribution to management of early stage breast cancer. And along the way, so much of the statistical methodology, subset analyses that came out of that work has just, you know, defined it. I used to tell our fellows that if you just read the NSABP papers, you will know essentially everything you need to know about adjuvant treatment of early stage breast cancer and neoadjuvant therapy. The only piece you would miss would be dose-dense therapy, which, you know, was a tweak to the AC and taxane regimens. Sorry, that was a long answer, but it's an extraordinary legacy.
No, that was a really incredible summary. And, you know, actually, you know, when you think about it, he met such resistance from the surgeons about the idea of, I mean, just gigantic resistance, overwhelming. And, you know, really, the only way he could prove it was with a randomized trial. And you think about it, randomizing a woman to mastectomy or breast conservation, you know, executing that trial. But, you know, in a way, once they did that, what happened, what you described, then they had the randomized trial mechanism, and they took it and ran with it.
Now, and these guys had guts. You're exactly right. I mean, so to randomize women to a lumpectomy or a mastectomy, which was a hugely loaded issue, they were accused of killing women, of, you know, at the same time, the other people were accused of mutilating women. And then the adjuvant chemotherapy trials, I mean, they were accused of poisoning people and killing them to treat women who had no evidence of cancer. So, you know, really challenging times, really powerful studies, and a truly remarkable legacy. And Fisher also was a huge advocate for large randomized trials because he knew the power of them. So there, as you may remember, there was a big scandal involving
right,
the NSABP
right,
trials.
Right, right, right.
There was an investigator at one of the sites in Montreal who had essentially had scientific misconduct and had cheated on the reports. And the NSABP analyzed all their data without that site, and the data were still perfect. And it just made the point that there is so much power to doing multi-center cooperative group studies. It's an extraordinary contribution, and his like don't come along often.
Yeah, and he was 101 when he passed. The other thing I was just thinking about, you were mentioning HER2 in, you know, 2005 when all the trials came out. But then there was San Antonio 2018, the Catherine trial. And to me, that was the next gigantic step in HER2-positive disease.
So, you know, the other big thing that came out of San Antonio was an update on capecitabine in the adjuvant setting for triple-negative breast cancer, which looks to have activity. And so the Catherine study, which is T-DM1 for residual disease, the CREATE-X study, which is capecitabine for triple-negative residual disease, those studies have really shifted how we think about using neoadjuvant treatment. So 9 years ago, the goal was, let's push the PCR rate up as high as possible. That'll be the best regimen. Everybody should get it. And now, increasingly, we're talking about adaptive or tailored regimens where we use good regimens to achieve good rates of PCR. But we know that we can salvage people who have residual disease by giving them adjuvant therapy that's a switch from what they had earlier. And that paradigm now of finding women who have residual disease as a high-risk group for extra intervention is, I think, a lot about how FDA is thinking about the role of neoadjuvant therapy, and many investigators are joining that.
You mentioned the NSABP B18 preoperative study. In a way, it was a big disappointment because Fisher's laboratory work, he thought maybe neoadjuvant, you're going to see a greater effect on disease-free survival. But the ironic thing is, when it finally, at least in HER2-positive disease, when it finally played out, you kind of achieved the same thing by sort of doing this test and then following up after surgery.
Right. You're exactly right. The B18 hope was that by giving chemo early, you would actually help patients do yet even better. That proved not to be the case because systemic therapy works pre or post. But it also opened the door to all these other surrogates that are now part of FDA approval plans and, you know, our day-to-day work.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Burstein, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special spinoff program to a satellite meeting held during the 2019 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium.